This is Solve It for Kids.
Hello, my amazing friends. You are looking so cute. You are. You're looking so curious today and wonderful. Welcome to Solve It, the podcast that gives kids and families a peek into the real world of scientists, engineers, and experts as they solve problems in their jobs using curiosity, cooperation, creativity, and critical thinking. My name is Jed Lee. Please welcome to the show my partner in exploration, the dean of all things STEM and STEAM, Jennifer Swanson.
Hello, Jed.
Hey, Jennifer, how's everything down in Jacksonville?
It is wonderful. How are things up in Boston?
Cold.
I would imagine. But you know what is going to get you excited is the show that we have today. It is so cool.
So cool. Well, let's get right to it, okay?
Yeah, let's spin the wheel.
How can science restore a masterpiece painting?
How can we use science to restore a beautiful masterpiece? I have no idea.
I mean, this is just amazing. This is science and art. It's STEAM. And we have an amazing expert to talk to us today about this. It's Dr. Suzanne Quillen-Lomax, who is a senior scientist at the National Gallery of Art.
We have a National Gallery of Art?
Yes, in Washington, D.C., and she works there and does such cool things to help restore masterpieces. Let's welcome her to the show.
Thank you so much.
We are so excited to have you. So, for those of our listeners who may not know what the National Gallery of Art is, can you start by telling us a little bit about that amazing place?
Okay, well, the National Gallery of Art is in Washington, D.C., and it's on the National Mall with the Smithsonian Museums, but we're not part of the Smithsonian. We're an independent organization, and the collection is primarily European and American works of art that post date about 1200. Most of what is on view are paintings, but we have other things in our collection. We have sculpture. We have a lot of works on paper, watercolors, prints, engravings, etchings. We have textiles. We have ceramics. Wow. And it's a wonderful place to visit and a wonderful place to work.
It is. I mean, there's so many different things that you have there. I'm sure there's different ways that they're all displayed. Some of them are in frames. Some of them are in other, like, what other ways are they displayed, I guess?
Well, we have things that are in cases, and those cases are usually called vitrines. They're usually glass cases for a lot of delicate things like ceramics. Mm-hmm. We have statues that might be freestanding in the gallery. We have life-size statues. We have some textiles, and those would be hanging on walls. They're not carpets that are on the floor. They actually hang on the walls because we don't want people to walk on them and touch them.
I have to ask you, Dr. Suzanne, every time I go into an art museum, and I love it, it always seems to be like one of the security people are like following me around, keeping their eyes on me. I know I like to touch things, but they're always, and they, I think that they must sense that because they're always following me around, making sure I don't touch anything. Why is that so important?
Well, because we don't want, every time you touch something, you have the potential for damaging it. I know a lot of people don't do it in a malicious way, but we just don't want things touched because we don't want them to be damaged. And comes where they're sort of more touch, but not in our museum. The works of art are not meant to be touched.
Well, especially if they're so old. I mean, you definitely have probably spend a lot of time, as you said, your question is about restoring. So let's talk a little bit about restoring before you explain how they're restored. Why would it need to be restored?
So in general, the materials in the paintings are aging, just like we are aging. Oh. And some of those materials would change color as they age. So, for example, on a painting, there's usually a coating on the top of a painting, and we call that the varnish. And so you might think of it like furniture. You know, furniture has a coating on it, and that's a varnish. And that can change colors over time. And so what happens if it's on a painting is that the painting starts to look dark and it's kind of hard to see what's underneath it. And so that varnish has to come off periodically. And sometimes things do get damaged. If you have a work of art that's hundreds of years old, it's probably been damaged over its history. And so that might be why a painting needs to be restored. And so there's special people at the National Gallery, and they're called conservators. So they conserve or preserve works of art, and they specialize. So we have people who conserve paintings, what we call objects. So that would be statues and furniture and things like that. Works of art on paper and photographs and textiles. And so they specialize and are able to do really good jobs on restoring the works of art.
I guess I never thought of paintings growing old. I know there was a story about a portrait that hung in a closet, and that got old while the person didn't get old. But what is it about what's going on, like either in a painting or a photograph, that ages?
Well, on things like photographs, one of the things that's a problem is the photographic materials themselves, but also the paper. Because paper can age and it can change color. I mean, if you think of a book, you know, sometimes if you see an old book, like the paper's kind of yellowed.
Yes.
So that has aged over time. And a lot of times with a painting that's hundreds of years old, somebody has done restoration work on it in the past, but now the colors don't match up anymore. And so it has to be redone periodically.
So that's true. So I've been to some amazing museums around the world and seen old paintings. And you're right. A lot of them do look really dark. Like the colors are faded. And I, you know, after you look at so many, you just think, wow, that was just like a dark period, I guess, for these people, that they just, everything is black and dark brown. But what you're saying is if the varnish were removed, it's possible that they would be lighter.
Right. Now, there's some artists who would maybe paint with dark colors.
Right.
I think a lot of Dutch paintings like Rembrandt, like the portraits, there's always a really dark background.
Yeah.
But a lot of times it's the discoloration of this varnish layer that is making the painting look dark like that.
It sounds like something that you have to be very careful when you're doing the restoration. Yes. It sounds like it could take a long time. You have a picture right over your head of like a beautiful little girl, like a picture that size. It might be, it looks like it might be 8x10. How long could it take to restore something like that?
Something like that could take months, if not a year or more, to do a restoration.
Wow. Okay. So now I'm curious. Tell us about the science that you're doing, because how do you get this varnish off without damaging the picture or the, you know, painting?
Right. So, that work is done by the conservators, and what they do is they basically roll little swabs that look like little tiny Q-tips, and they are going to dip that in a solvent. So a solvent is, a liquid. Can be water, but in most cases with paintings, it's not water. And what they want to do is to be able to remove the varnish layer without disturbing the paint layers that are underneath. And so they have to be really careful with what solvent they pick that's strong enough to take the varnish off, but not so strong that the paint starts to come off. And so as a scientist, I can help them by figuring out what is the varnish on the painting.
Oh, okay. So then you get to figure out which solvents to use.
Right. And so then I can say, oh, that's what this varnish is. And then they can say, oh, okay, now I know that. Maybe I should use this particular solvent. And so that's one of the ways that we can help in restoration. And another thing that we can do is that we can help to figure out if a certain area of a painting is original or whether it's been restored. Because you want to remove all the old restoration on a painting, and you don't want to take off anything that's original. And so what we'll try to do is analyze an area and see, you know, I guess I should explain what paint is first.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I was thinking if we could talk, is it like layers?
Like, yes. So I'm imagining, you know, when I look at a painting, I just think it's just a painting, but it's not like a photograph. It's different layers, right?
It's a lot of different layers. And so if you think of a painting, so it's painted on something. So the lowest layer is right. What you painted it on. And in our museum, it's almost always a piece of wood. So artists actually painted on wooden panels. And sort of about the time of the early Renaissance, they started painting on canvas. So canvas is fabric.
Right.
And so those are the two primary supports that we have. And then on top of the support, you put down what it's like a priming layer. So it could be like a white paint or a buff colored paint or maybe a bit red paint. But there'd be some kind of a primer, and that kind of fills in all the little irregularities on the support, and it sort of prepares the support to take the paint layers. And so that priming layer is a paint. So paint is made up of pigments, which are what's the color.
Right.
And some sort of material that we call a binding medium. So it's something that you mix with the pigment so it goes on wet and then it dries over time. So might be a good idea for people to think about what could you use as both pigments and binding media. So pigments, how do you get things that are color? The most common thing that you can think of is a rock, like a mineral of some kind.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
And
the
so
natural colors.
Historically,
yeah.
Mineral pigments have been used really commonly. But you can also take things like roots of plants and make pigments out of them. You can take bugs and you can squash them and you can make pigments out of them.
Oh my gosh.
Or you can make pigments in a laboratory. Okay. So that's something I'm really fascinated by are modern pigments that are made in laboratories. Okay. So that's the pigment part.
Can I ask you a question there?
Sure.
Okay, so what would you do with the bugs? I mean, so you squash them, and they have the pigment, but then you have to mix it with, you said, some kind of binding agent.
Right.
So what would you use as the binding agent?
Okay, so the binding agents, in the case of the bugs, you probably, before you mix it with the binders, you would, what we call mordant it. You would put it onto something that's white and inert to actually make it from a kind of this mushy, liquidy thing into a pigment. But in terms of the binders, there's some unusual things that have been used for binders. When you think of painting now, most people probably think of oil paint.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's been used historically for hundreds of years. Or now today we have things like acrylic paint. And so there are acrylics that are used in fine art. But actually one of the things that they used to use was egg. And so they would mix either egg yolk with or whole egg, or they would make a varnish out of egg white, which is, of course, the, you know, clear white part. Mm-hmm. So it would go on clear. And so egg has been used a lot historically for painting.
I did not know that. That is cool.
Yeah. Different kinds of oils, acrylics. Those are the most common things that are used as binders.
Wow, that's amazing. Now, how do you figure out what is what? I take it Rembrandt didn't put a little tag on the back of his painting saying this is made of this and that and that. I made squished up this bug to
that
make
that would have been
pigment.
Nice, right?
Yeah, it would have been really nice. Yeah,
I probably would not have had a job now if he had done that, but that would be really nice. So we have a whole lot of different kinds of instrumentation that we use. And so there's three main kinds of instrumentation that we have. And the first one is called chromatography. So chroma is actually derived from color. So it's separating things into all of their parts. So if we have a mixture of materials and we want to separate it, we can do chromatography. And there's different kinds of chromatography. Another technique that we use is called spectroscopy. So in spectroscopy, you're shining a light on something and you're figuring out what light's absorbed and what light is reflected.
Oh,
and that light
cool.
can be visible light that we see. It can be infrared light, which is like heat. and it can be x-rays. So there's different techniques that we have that are what we call spectroscopic. So we're doing spectroscopy. And the third type of instrumentation that we have is microscopy. So a microscope. So we are magnifying things and looking at them. And we can do that with what's called an optical microscope that you might have at your school where you look at something like pond water or just something and we magnify it a little bit. And we do that with mineral pigments. We look at them and we look at their properties and we can identify them. And then we have something that magnifies hundreds of thousands of times, and that's called a scanning electron microscope.
And those are cool. Those are cool. I did a book on nanotechnology. Cool. I'm like, wow, scanning electron microscopes. Jen's going, I don't even have any clue what that is.
It's cool science. If it wasn't on Star Trek, I didn't catch it.
No, we don't have a tricorder from Star Trek.
Oh, see. Sorry
to say. That would make life even easier.
Yeah, it would.
I'm curious, how did you become interested in restoring paintings? I've never met anybody who said, I want to grow up and restore paintings.
Well, I didn't say that when I was a kid either. I've always been interested in science, and my mother was a math and science teacher, and so I've always just loved science. And when I went to undergraduate school and graduate school, I majored in chemistry, and I'm an organic chemist. Mm-hmm. And so that's someone who studies materials that are carbon containing. And but I've always liked going to art museums, and I've always really loved history and art history. Figuring out when people lived and what their interactions were has been really special. And so this is a career that combines a love of science and a love of art, because everything is based on the works of art. And so really having a lot of knowledge of art history is a huge help with this.
Oh, yeah.
Because you'll know, when did a certain artist live? Mm-hmm. So we'll know, yeah. Well, gee, what techniques did that artist have? What materials did he or she have to work with? Because if something hadn't been invented until like the 1900s, you're not going to find it on a painting from 1500 unless there's something wrong.
Which is how you know if it's fake or not, right?
Right. It's not only how you know it's fake, but it also can be how you know whether some area of the painting is not original.
Oh, so, it might so be if there is a restoration.
It might be restoration.
Oh, that's cool.
So we might have a painting and some of it has flaked off over time and somebody restored it. And so when we're doing analysis, maybe we do find materials that were not available to the artist. But we can't immediately say, well, this is a fake. What we have to think about is, do we see this everywhere? Is it only on the top layer of the painting versus a layer that's further down? So, so a little detective work there.
So I want to know, because clearly in order to do this analysis, you have to take a sample from the painting. How do you do that without damaging or wrecking the painting?
Oh, very, very carefully. So, yeah, everything that I do, we call destructive analysis. So destructive in the sense that I have to take a sample. But we're moving a lot in the field to being able to do imaging and other analyses that we don't have to take a sample. So not everything that we do requires a sample. It kind of depends on the question and what we're able to answer. But if I need to take a sample, what I do is we lay the work of art down on a table. So it's facing down, facing up, but down on a table. And then we wheel over a microscope. And then we have these little scalpels that are used for eye surgery and things like that. And we can take a little sample. Now, wherever possible, I try to take a sample from the edge of a painting because it's going to be something that people aren't going to see because the frame is going to go back around it. But, or I try to take a sample from an area where there's what we call a loss. So there's this paint that's already been lost because then the conservator is going to have to fix that.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Sometimes we just take a sample because it needs to come from a certain area. So, in general, as I said, we try to take it from an area where there's loss. But the samples are really, really small. So if I do my job right, you should not be able to see where the sample came from. I mean, it would be small, way smaller than the head of a pin.
Wow. Well, because I'd be freaking if I had like a Renoir or something. I'd be like, oh my gosh. I'd be afraid to touch it, let alone go at it with a tiny little scalpel.
it takes a little practice and effort to get used to doing it. And I also found out I can't do it first thing in the morning. I do it first thing in the morning before I've had a cup of coffee or something. You don't want your hands shaking when you're doing it.
Oh, yeah.
This is going to sound like a silly question, Dr. Susan, but I'm known for that. But I need some help because I go around and there are a lot of times I'll go to a museum and there'll be some things that I love. I love a lot of colors. Mm-hmm. And then other things, they're like, okay, I can understand how somebody else would love that. But there was this one, at least one time, I was at a museum and I went into this room and there was this big giant canvas and it was painted blue. And I'm like,
and that's it?
That was it. That was it. It was blue, and there was like an explanation of what the artist was trying to say. But I'm like, dude, that's just blue. so I don't get that. Is there a way you can help me? Because I know it's me. It's just I'm not able to get it right now.
There are lots of things I like and lots of things that I'm not crazy about also in art. But one of the painters that I like a lot is Mark Rothko, who is a modern painter. He died in 1970, but he was active in between the 30s up until 1970. And he's known for large paintings that are, they're not just one color. So with all due respect to your blue, he might have a couple shades of a color on it. But to me, they're beautiful and they are deep in terms of the colors. And they're really, I find them very soothing and very relaxing. Yeah. So I think it's just an idea of what you like and what you don't like and how the art makes you feel.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Does it make you feel happy? Does it make you think about things? And that's especially true for things that are what we call non-representational art, so abstract. So it's not like a portrait or a landscape or some interior scene or something. It's something that's just, it's up to you to figure out what it is and what it means to you. Yeah. So
use your imagination, Jed.
You have to use your imagination and you also... Yeah, not everything speaks to everybody. So that's part of the beauty of it.
Yeah. Not everybody speaks to me either. I get my wife mad at me sometimes, and she doesn't speak to me.
Well, so I have a question. So since it takes so long to restore a painting, do you work on multiple paintings at once?
Or? Yeah, the conservators in general are working on several different paintings at a time. And I'm, in general, doing analysis. I have a lot of different projects that are going on at one time. And we also, as the scientists, we work for all of our conservation departments. So I'm not only working on paintings, but I'm working on sculptures. I'm working on works of art on paper, so maybe there's a question on a watercolor, or I work with our textile conservator on a variety of projects, trying to figure out like what the dyes are in something or fibers. So at any one time, I would probably have at least a half a dozen of these little projects going on, in addition to some sort of bigger things. So and then the conservators are working on a lot of restorations at once, but also other projects too. So if you think about it, if you want to send a painting to go to another museum to be shown,
right,
you can't just put it in the mail. Okay.
True.
It has to go, and somebody usually has to go with it. And so that's called a courier. So you are on a courier trip when you're taking a work of art to another museum. So a lot of the conservators are doing courier trips. And before it can leave our museum, it has to be checked out to make sure there aren't any damages or problems with it. So they do these condition checks. And then when they take it to another museum, then they have to uncrate it and they have to make sure it's okay. And they have to make sure it's installed okay. So there's a lot of different things that the conservators are working on at any one time.
So I've also heard because that you have, or some of these museums have really huge collections, and so they only display a certain number of, you know, paintings or whatever they have. So do you guys have like a secret vault where you keep all the rest of them, or that you can tell us about?
yes, there is a lot of storage, and some of it is on site at the National Gallery, and we also have off-site storage.
And then do you pick to rotate them around? Like,
well, yes, there are people at the gallery who do that, and those are the curators. So the curators are the people who are responsible for acquisition and display of the collection. And so they might be working on having a special exhibition, and they'll want to borrow something, and then it's like, well, then we have to lend something to someone. So,
is that how it works? You borrow and you lend.
Exactly. So there's museums that you have a good relationship with where, you know, you, if they ask for something, you want to be able to reciprocate and borrow something from them. Some places in DC can borrow and display works from the collection. So things like the Supreme Court, in other offices. And we have something called the National Lending Service where things can be lent to small museums. And so it's true that only a very small part of our collection's on display, but it's in storage or things are being borrowed or...
Well, there you go, Jed. You could just borrow one of their paintings. I'm sure they would just, you know, send something right up to you.
Put it right here.
Put it right there. I have to, Dr. Susan, we ask this a lot of times. I'm almost afraid to ask this. But, you know, one of the things we want kids to understand is that, you know, failure is part of science. That's how we grow. But, like, when you're working with priceless works of art, I'm thinking, I don't know, have you ever had, like, any kind of epic failures?
That you want to tell us about?
Well, I feel actually quite proud. I've been at the National Gallery for over 30 years, and I've never lost a sample.
Yay! That's awesome.
It's really, really tiny. So
yeah.
I've always been able to take a sample and then put it in a vial and keep track of it. So that's one place where things could go wrong is that you can lose something that's really, really, really tiny. I can't think of an epic fail. There's been instances where I'm not able to get results on a sample. Oh. So I can't figure out what it is. And one of the nice things about our field is that it's very small. So there's not a lot of scientists who work in art restoration. And so we all kind of know each other. And so we help each other out. So I might say, hey, you know, I have this sample and this is what its chromatogram looks like or this or that. Has anybody ever seen something like that? So there's still been a few cases where I've been stumped and I haven't been able to figure out what something is. But not so much epic fails. I haven't like put a big hole in a painting or anything. Thank goodness.
Well, that's very good. And I'm sure your bosses all appreciate that.
So
what would a kid do if they wanted to be like you or to work at a museum? I mean, like what would they pursue along the way?
Well, most of the people who are scientists in this discipline get a degree in chemistry. There are people who have other degrees in allied sciences, physics, material science, and things like that. I would suggest like volunteering in a museum if you can. Even when you go to college, majoring in a science, but also maybe having another degree in either studio art or art history.
Oh yeah.
Would be really, really good. Just sort of perseverance after that point. That it's a small field and there's not a lot of positions, but, there's some very tenacious people who, have been getting temporary positions at different places because they just love working in art restoration.
That sounds like a really cool place to work.
Hey, yeah. You know, I think it's never too early for our kids to start learning the science behind some of the great jobs. Do you have a challenge, something that our kids could do right now that would kind of give them a feel of what it's like to be an art restorer?
Yeah, one of the things that's kind of fun to do in terms of the science part of it is to do chromatography on markers. So markers, either permanent markers or non-permanent markers. So I'm going to start with the non-permanent. So if you had a collection of different colors of non-permanent markers, and then you had some sort of absorbent paper, and this can be a paper towel or can be a coffee filter. And you cut that into a strip, and then you put a little dot from the marker, maybe about an inch up from the bottom of your strip. And if it's a non-permanent marker, you're going to put it in a beaker or a cup of water, and you want the dot to be above the level of the water so that the water travels up, hits the dot, and then goes up your paper towel or your coffee filter. And what'll happen is the color that the marker is made out of is going to travel along, and if it's made up of different colors, they will separate out. And you can just carry on until it gets to fairly close to the top. You don't want it to go over the top. And what happens is the water's absorbing up the towel and taking the color with it, and the pigments or the colors from the markers will separate out based pretty much on how big that molecule is. So if something is smaller, it can go faster. And so it'll travel further up. And you can do the same thing with permanent markers. Now, permanent markers, you're probably going to want to help from a grown-up, because first of all, they're permanent, so you don't want to mark yourself up or the coffee table or whatever. But the thing is, you can't use water for that. You have to use something like rubbing alcohol, because they're permanent markers. So they don't dissolve in water. And so you could carry out exactly the same thing with permanent markers and using rubbing alcohol. And what you can also find out, like things like Sharpies, you'll find that there are lots of different colors in them. So a black marker will have yellow in it. It'll have blue in it in addition to black. Purple markers will have pink in them as well as blue. And so you'll see all of those colors coming out. And so that's a form of chromatography that I talked about earlier. So it's a way of analyzing mixtures by separating out the chemicals into their parts. And so even though that marker writes in one color, it's actually made up of a mixture of different colors or pigments. And so as the solvent, so your water or your alcohol, moves up, it's separating them out into their colors. And that produces, that thing that you get that's so pretty and colorful is what we call a chromatogram. And there are a lot of different kinds of chromatography, and we do several of them at my work. We don't do this paper chromatography. But
it would be fun, though.
It would be fun. We would have a blast. It's just a great way of seeing how you can separate things out, and it's nice and colorful. So
it is. I've done this experiment before. It's really cool. So listeners, if you do this, try this paper chromatography, take a picture of it, and with your parents' permission, tag us on our Instagram or our Twitter, which is @KidSolve, or you can email it to us at our website, solveitforkids.com. Or leave a comment also on our website, because we will have a website page that will have Dr. Suzanne's information on it. We'll have a link to the National Gallery of Art. You can see some of these beautiful paintings there. And also I'll find directions, and we'll put directions for how to do this challenge, which I think is so cool and fun. But we want to see what colors you get from your markers. That would be neat.
That'd be awesome. Awesome. I've learned so much. I still don't know about the blue painting, but I learned so much talking to you today. Thanks for being on the show, Dr. Susan.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. It's been fabulous having you on the Solve It for Kids.
Thank you so much for having me.
Wow, Jennifer, that was like a beautiful interview.
It was, wasn't it? And I mean, who would have thought that you have to use all this kind of science to actually work on a painting and bring it
back to life, so to speak.
And I love that challenge. I mean, like taking the marker and put it in the and get seeing the colors separate and everything. That's going to be so cool to do.
Yes, it is science in action. So for those of you who want all of the instructions on how to do this challenge, be sure to go to our website, solveitforkids.com, click on the challenge page, and you will see everything out there explained so that you can do this at home. And don't forget to send us your pictures and tag us on our Twitter and Instagram at kids solve, because we would love to see how you do with this experiment.
Yeah, and we'd love for you to be the person who wins the book.
Yes, wouldn't that be awesome? And the other thing that we have that we really need to tell teachers and homeschoolers about, Jed, is that now you can use our podcast in your classroom.
Yeah, and you've put together these amazing teacher packs.
Yes, the teacher packs. So far we have 2 episodes, and the third one's on its way. So you can learn about how to map an underwater forest or how to move water from one place to the other. Just find us on Teacher Pay Teachers at Solve It for Kids, and you can check them out.
I can't wait to check that out, and I can't wait to see you next week for another exciting episode of
Solve It for Kids.